Hello and welcome to Shoot the Piano Player, a French New Wave podcast. I'm still trying to remember not to say Spike Lee season one and the Kurosawa season one. Okay, so this is the companion episode to La Pointe Court, which is the first Agnès Varda film, kind of the first French New Wave film. And so I kind of use this excuse of, well, La Strada came out that year, and this is an excuse to finally watch La Strada. So, yeah, so La Strada, how did you first...
The end.
Yeah, the end. Do you remember the first time you ever heard of... Well, actually, what was your first Italian movie, if you can even, like, remember, like, specifically your first Italian movie, or got you into, like, Italian movies?
Well, first of all, my name is Joel. Nice to meet you. I'm the co-host. I don't even know if Spencer introduced himself, but he's the host.
Yeah, probably not.
I mean, kind of co-host, but, you know, anyways. So, yeah, first Italian movie was Pinocchio. And, yes, the Disney one. But, no, that's not actually Italian. Like, if I remember Italian movies I saw when I was younger, I can specifically remember the Roberto Benigni starring Pinocchio and thinking that was super weird. But I don't think that one's actually in Italian. I think either that or I watched a dub version. But that was weird. Like, that should not be a live action anything, especially with a grown man pretending to be a puppet boy.
The story... already it's like is body horror. It's terrifying.
Yeah, no good. And then, like, things that I didn't know were Italian that I'd seen before I started watching actual Italian movies were The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and a couple of other of those cheesy westerns from that era where the voices are dubbed over, you know, Italian directors and everything like that. But that's Clint Eastwood or whatever. Like, no, those are basically Italian movies.
Yeah, we're going to cover at least one of them. Actually, yeah. I think two. A couple of them, actually.
Yeah. I think, but like I said on the last episode, like, watching Umberto D in one of my classes was, like, so eye-opening, and, like, I was dying to get more, so I watched a bunch of other neorealist stuff, but I also watched, never mind, it was all neorealist. I don't even know. I'm trying to think of movies from that era. I also saw, like, Paisan, or let's see, what else do we got?
Oh, do you want to know what my first Italian movie was?
No, I'm not done yet.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's a movie that I owned on DVD for a while. I watched about four times, once with a commentary, because it's a thing of, I own the movie, so I'm supposed to like it, right? And if you've heard my episode on Cinema Parlor on The Baby, I talk about this very thing. It was Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah, that is Italian. That's classic Italian.
Yeah, it's a movie I think is irresponsibly shitty and unnecessary for many reasons, including the obvious ones. And also, I think it's just a shitty movie to begin with. But that's enough about that movie. We don't need to give it more press.
Yeah, you're not really selling it to me.
If you're like an edgy 16-year-old who wants to see the most extreme shit, watch it. If you're older than 16, I don't see a point in sitting through it. There's no reason to.
Sure.
And this is coming from someone who loves, like, Lars von Trier. So, like, There's like gross, like uncomfortable, where it's like there's a point to it, and there's gross uncomfortable, which you're like, you're just trying to be shocking. Stop it. But and then that's followed up by Suspiria a couple years later, which is, if I'm being honest, probably like top 20 favorite movies ever. And it was my favorite horror movie for like a very long time. And I bought it on Amazon purely because I saw the cover, and I saw that I recognized the title from some things, and I was like, it's $5. You know, it has to be worth $5 at least, right? And that kicked off like an Argento obsession, which I don't think we'll do an Argento episode. That's a little too,
it's been done.
Yes, it's been done. Like, if we do an Argento movie, it'll be Tenebrae, and only Tenebrae. Like, there's no other Argento movie I would like. I love the first 15 years of his movies, like, unabashedly. Oh, we're doing Deep Red, actually. I forgot we're doing that. But, so it'll be Deep Red and Tenebrae. And others, like, I love, but I also just, I just want to, like, keep it to a minimum for other other people. Cause,
certainly.
Yeah. And so, like...
Well, if you want to hear me talk about an Argento movie, please don't send me in outer space. Has an episode on Phenomena, a.k.a. Creepers, which is very good, if you haven't seen that.
That's the last of the Argento that I unabashedly love. After that, it kind of starts going... it starts getting worse. He bounces back up in the 90s with his Rape Revenge movie starring his daughter, which is kind of weird. But it's Argento, and he has a weird thing with putting his daughter in his movies. I'm not going to judge him.
You just did.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, it's... yeah. Maybe we're American prudes. I don't know.
I didn't say anything about it. I'm all for it. Anytime he wants to put his daughter up there.
Okay. Alright, but... yeah, and so then... I didn't start watching, like, the, like, classy Italian movies until... Maybe it was until I saw The Tenth Victim, and I was like, oh, I gotta see more, because like I consider Elio Petri to be like one of the classy directors of his era. If you hear me talk about Elio Petri, listen to Movies from Hell, where I was on an episode with John Arminio. We talked about a couple our Petri movies, and he was an amazing auteur, but the Italian government didn't like his political opinions, and so they censored his movies, and some stuff happened out of his control that kind of ruined a reputation for one movie that is hard to find now, but if you know where to look for it, you can find it. But, getting back to the main topic... I saw my first Fellini in college in literature class, and it was Satyricon, because we just read the Satyricon. I still have my book from college, from that class, of the Satyricon. And I really love that movie. I think it was the first or second art film I ever saw. Because first, it was either that or it was Antichrist. I saw them roughly like around the same time, so I can't remember which I saw first. But like a Satyricon just made me go like, "Who the fuck is Fellini? I have to see more of his movies." And I kind of never did, but it was always in the back of my mind of like, one of these days.
Yeah, you're fine.
All right.
He's not going anywhere.
All right, what was your first Fellini?
Probably 8.5. Let me see. Considering I've only seen 8.5 in La Strada, it must have been 8.5. That's the one, though. That's the one. People are like, 8.5. You have to see 8.5. We're going to make a musical based on 8.5, but we're adding a half, so it's 9 now. Okay, half. Half, 9. And you know what? They're right. It is really good. But I don't know. That's all I got.
Yeah. Eight and a half is coming up because it's Marcello. And that means we have to cover
Marcello. Yes, your boyfriend Marcello, of course.
He's everyone's boyfriend, come on.
I don't know. We didn't get to see him launch into a swimming pool full of alligators, and that's what the 10th victim promised me.
Yeah, well, if you want to see him as a psychopathic priest, watch, I forgot what it's called. The Petri movie, mid-70s, the...
Jeez, here it is. Great Bikini Off-Road Adventure.
Yeah. No, it's the one that's impossible to find. I don't think... It has a Blu-ray in Germany, and that's only Blu-ray available because it's kind of... Italian government doesn't want that movie getting out there. It's too critical of the church and of the and politics.
I see.
But Lestrada, this was the first Fellini feature, and I like this movie overall. There are some parts I really like, but my main complaint is it didn't really start coming alive for me until they joined the circus halfway through. And once you get more of, is it Massimo? What's that guy, the other guy's name?
You talking about the fool?
Yeah, the fool. Once he starts showing...
That's what his career is called, yeah.
Yeah, once he starts getting in the way, that's where I'm like, okay, that's when it really kicked into gear, and then the rest of the movie, we know, was fine. Not fine, but, I was into it. It's just, the first, 40 minutes or so, I was kind of not that I wasn't enjoying it, it was kind of it got to a point of, yep, he's a, Zampano is abusive, and, Gelsomino? It's one of those long Italian names. I'm not sure. I can't remember what it is.
Giasomina. Yes. Let's just call her Mina.
Mina. Yeah. I wrote gel in my notes because I bet. But.
Because you had to put in an order at Target for some more hair gel.
Yes. And it's she's gonna, tolerate it, but also try to assert her independence, but he's going to crush her will, which I think is kind of the point of the movie, just to show, the abusive relationship, which I feel might be, a political statement of some kind. I'm not totally sure. Yeah. I don't know. It's a road movie, and road movies can just be a metaphor for a lot of things of the people they come across and shit.
Sure, but I think the having to be on the road has more to do with their economic look rather than, and it's kind of plainly painted out there the way that a neorealism would. Is we're not sugarcoating it. We're not really doing symbolism or something like that. It just kind of is, and it's like. This one, like you were saying, Fellini was basically neorealism was fun. Now let's do an actual movie with a story. So it's got those elements, but it is this is the beginning of the story, this is the end of the story kind of thing.
Yeah, or maybe I got the feeling he is Umberto D is amazing, but what if it's not oppressively sad?
Yeah, he failed at that because this one is pretty fucking sad.
It's not Umberto D.
It's not oppressively sad. I mean, it's got the same sense of humor that Bicycle Thieves and Umberto D have, which, it's humor of everyday life kind of thing. This has at least a character that is kind of like a Charlie Chaplin, stand-in, but she
Or Rachel Dratch, as I put in my notes.
Wow, you think this woman is just as attractive as the gorgeous Rachel Dratch? That's amazing.
Dratch is very attractive to me. Don't disrespect her.
No, I'm not joking.
Look,
I'm saying it's not. Some people will think that you're saying a bad thing about her.
It's not that
and
kind.
I'm saying she's attractive.
It's not that kind of show, but you know, like she's a MILF.
Oh boy.
Yeah, you heard me.
Actually, and Anthony Quinn is just a specimen of a man.
He's fine.
That's what that was the joke. He's not. I mean, he's supposed to be the strong man and everything like that. It's like, yeah, he's fit. He's more fit than I've ever been in, but he's not. I wouldn't call him buff.
Yeah, like this is the era when Bronson starts showing up in movies, and even in the early days, Bronson was like super ripped.
Yeah.
Although
54 is a bit early for that, wasn't that like a?
But he was already in House of Wax by this point.
Oh, okay. I didn't know when he started doing westerns and such. It was like in the '60s.
That would have been '60s. He was still moving up, but like, he also I think would have been too short for his role too.
Yeah. Hmm. Oh no! I mean, he couldn't have been in this.
No, know, if only.
Like Yeah. What was I even going on about? Oh yeah, I don't think these films will service anybody by trying to look for the symbolism on what's going on rather than just watching them for what's actually being seen on the screen. So that's like, for me, that takes away from like what I'm going for, especially if it's obvious, you know?
Yeah. But like, because like part of it feels, Boonwell ish. Because Boonwell had been around for this point 30-something years. And so his, like, kind of surrealist sensibility, like, there's some moments in this that feel surreal. Like the Boonwell type of surreal, where, like, there's...
Sure.
When Zampano leaves her, because he's with the curvy redhead, which becomes a thing that you see in a lot of... Apparently you see a lot of Fellini movies is like curvy women.
I mean, yeah, that's, I mean, 8.5 is basically going for that. That's where all the curvy women came from. They came from Italy, so he didn't really have a choice.
Yeah, and like, and his segment in, I forgot what the movie's called. It's an anthology film that's like 3 hours long that he does a segment and like, it's like taking stories from this, like, I think he was like a French, he's like a monk who wrote like these morality tales or something in the Middle Ages. I can't remember.
Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow or something like that.
No, it's a different thing. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is De Sica, just doing three like rom com setups for Sophia Loren and Marcello.
Sure.
Set in different time periods, but this movie is called, I can't remember the name of it, but the Fellini segment is a giant woman with giant breasts, and like you get these shots of like this giant woman holding this man, and you see like her giant cleavage, and it's like, huh, I bet this was someone's awakening for some fetish.
You find that movie so I can watch it immediately.
No. we are going to cover it. Because I like the Mario Monicelli segment a lot, and we'll talk about that one. The Fleeing one is fine.
Once again, another thing Woody Allen stole from the Italians.
What?
In Everything I Want to Know About Sex, I think there's a scene where these, I don't remember, it's like boobs that like just starting... They're obviously like balloons that start inflating to gigantic size.
Hmm.
Or, possibly, is it a reference in Private Parts, the Howard Stern story? Because something else happens in there? Okay, I'm just going to shut up. Why do I know so much about scenes where people's boobs grow?
they don't grow because like that Fellini segment is like this uptight, like very devout Catholic who... hates any like anything remotely sexual. There's a billboard outside his apartment, and the billboard is this curvy woman drinking milk in like a tight dress, and in his dreams at night, she comes alive and like toys with him throughout the town, and she like picks him up and plays with him, and she's like, "I'm just trying to like sell milk or something."
Mm. Find me a Catholic that hates sex, and I'll give you $5.
Well, he's an unmarried Catholic, so he can't have any sex. I think that's the point he's trying to make.
Oh, I see. Yeah, those people love sex even more than the people that actually get to do it.
I know. I went to Catholic school. There was a family that had 12 kids.
Yep. God said no contraceptives. Anyways, so Lestrada, you're saying that you thought it was just okay, basically.
The first quarter or so, first third, was just okay. And then after that, it gets, like, between good and great.
Hmm. I like the false pretense that the beginning has with this, you know, this man who shows up with his motorcycle to basically buy a replacement wife, although I don't think they're ever married.
No.
But to buy it from this stereotypical Italian mother, like, there's many movies that has this character. It's like, oh, woe is me, it's so terrible, but please do this for the family. Oh, don't go, you can't go, but really, I really need that money. Kind of thing, like, whining the whole time. And
it opens like a Mizoguchi movie of like, oh, well, a bunch of horrible shit's gonna happen to this woman because of society.
Yeah.
But it's never that oppressive. I mean, parts of it are very sad, but it never gets to like the Mizoguchi levels of like Life of Haru or something like that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this. I don't want her life. She's got a terrible life. But I do get what you're saying.
The women, she actually seems to find joy. Where like in a Mizoguchi movie, there'll be like a scene of joy that is then ruined because of, you know, some part in Japanese society.
She's still curious about the world. She's still easily pleased, and like all it would take was, you know, kind words. And I love the way Giulietta Masani, that was Federico Fellini's wife, right?
Yes. Yeah. She outlived him by a year.
Oh, good.
Yeah, they had... I was looking up her career and stuff, and I mean, this is old news for anyone who knows Fellini, but like, I was like, oh, Fellini must have had like a bunch of kids, because like I assume because like Buñuel had like a bunch of kids in the film industry and stuff, so like he must have had some kids, and he had like a son that died like within a couple weeks.
Yeah, that's bad.
Yeah, which makes me wonder, like, maybe his movies are so like colorful and joyful and like embrace life, maybe because like just the trauma of like dealing with like, you know, the one time you did have a kid, it didn't, you know, like the worst thing that could happen did happen.
I mean, I haven't seen enough of his movies to know what his like is, but 8.5, La Strada, and the parts of Amacord I've seen seem to be you know, general Italian life, but also like about this like the masculine perception of the world, like, yeah. Even in Amacord, you're following around this like this famous prostitute, at least for this town. It's like she's not a regular person. Everybody knows she's a prostitute, and she's constantly getting hit on, and she's into it. Like, okay, is this real life? I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I always hear there's a Wrong Girl episode where Tony Stella is on, it's 3.5 hours, maybe 4 hours, of mostly Tony Stella this gushing about why he loves Fellini. Mm. And he talks about, like, there's, like, a joyous spirit in a lot of Fellini. And, like, that, And apparently, in between takes and like explain stuff, like he would like, he was very active and he would like dance and like sing and like just be super expressive and, you know, it's like just be like it's be his huge character all the time.
Sure. Anyway, I was talking about the actress and you interrupted me.
Yes. Well,
because you wanted to talk about a marriage. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I mean, she was his muse. They, you know.
Well, she's amazing in this movie as well. Yeah. Like, I feel like Anthony Quinn does a very, very good job, and you know, he doesn't have to show much range for the thing. But the way her character wears the emotions on her face, like in expressive, like a mime, so that you can know exactly how she's feeling based on all these thoughts that are. It seemed to go into her head and then straight out because of some other experience or something else that she hears. Like the scene when the fool is talking to her and is quote-unquote comforting her. Like, he makes her feel better.
Yeah.
And kind of sets her up for her future death and, you know, potentially his own. But the way she goes from sad to... you know, thinking, oh, he's actually complimenting me, to him like being like, oh, you're so ugly, like, oh, she gets super sad. Like, of course you would get super sad, but like a normal person just be kind of like probably still faced, and she can't help but like have the reaction she's having, and I love it.
Yeah, she's like like, part of me watching this was thinking like, is she too kind of like, not too innocent, but like she almost seems like very childlike, like in certain way, like emotionally seems kind of childlike, and like she's never seems that much like an adult. Like, I'm not sure how old she's supposed to be, which I think doesn't really matter necessarily, but this kind of like adds to like the childlike nature of her,
right? Yeah, I mean, I think she is supposed to be coming off that way, but also kind of in between this world where she knows she's an adult who has to participate in adult things and is incredibly frustrated by her first experiences like that.
Yeah.
That, like, she has the, you know, in the beginning, her mother is talking about how, like, oh, you don't know how to do any work, so you can't do anything. And she's just, you know, sadly shaking her head, like, I know, I don't know how to do anything, so this is the best to go with this man. And along the way in the movie, we see that, like, oh, she's more than capable of learning how if somebody gives her the time to teach her or to, you know, just allow her time to learn something on her own, because, you know, by the end of it, she knows how to play the trumpet. She knows all the clown routines. The drum, you know, we see that.
Yeah, and you see...
upsetting, but also funny scene where she learns how to drum.
Yeah, like, you see the progression of their relationship between Zampano and her with the trumpet. Because, like, it starts out, she wants to play trumpet, and he's like, no, you can't play trumpet. And never gives a reason. Mm-hmm. And then, after he comes back from jail, you see her playing a trumpet. It's never really commented on. It's just if you remember that part, it's like, okay, he has lightened up somewhat.
She started pulling her weight, and he started giving her, you know, yeah, it became something.
Yeah, and I realized I didn't say what the surreal part in this movie was. It was the main one I remember is when she gets abandoned, and you see this a horse walking down the road like in the middle of the night. And that just feels this, like, such like a Buñuel type of like dream logic of this, like, I don't know, something about this seems dreamy and off in a way that I can't really explain.
It feels like how it feels when you're stuck in a foreign city and it's like early morning, and sometimes you'll just randomly see a horse. I mean, it felt relatable to me.
I mean, it felt like that in between of like, it's relatable, but also just like the way it's shot, and this like her sitting there for seemingly, you know, all night, And then, like, I don't know, it's like, it just felt, and there's another moment that felt kind of surreal-ish. I can't remember what it was exactly.
Well, I'd say the whole Murder of the Fool scene feels like a kind of a nightmare dream, like how it kind of escalates. Because, I don't know about you, but I was like, yeah, that fool does need to get the shit beaten out of him.
Oh, no, I liked the fool. I wanted him to kill Zampano.
And run off with the girl that he didn't like.
I mean, he's better than Zampano.
Of course, yeah. I mean, I don't know. If I had to be around a person like that, I would tear my hair out.
Well, he let her play...
I also wouldn't want to be about Zampano.
He let her play a horned instrument before Zampano let her, and Zampano was furious when he saw, you know, another man let her, you know, play a horn instrument.
You think that's why he was furious?
Well, it's notable that, like, he doesn't let her play the trumpet, but then Massimo's like, you want to play a trombone? And it's just this little, you know, step up of, like, now she gets to do something she wants to do.
Right, and, you know, it's a kindness, like, she needs this kind of kindness, but he also, the thing about the fool doing that is, like, he knows this is going to get underneath Zampano's skin if he does it.
Yeah.
It's not a, he's not doing it out of the kindness of his heart.
Yeah. But, okay, so you know how her sister died in the beginning?
I mean, they don't talk about it, yeah.
Do you think Zampano killed her?
I have no idea.
They never answer
it.
Yeah,
I didn't really ever question what it was. I mean, she brings it up even, and he's like, I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, which so. I can't help to think is this, like, because he's, you know, an angry man, angry at the world for, you know, everything, which, not symbolic necessarily, but it just shows, because I suspect, because it's set in modern times, so I suspect maybe he was a veteran of World War II, and he saw the fallout of World War II in Italy, which, if you've seen Umberto D, you know, was kind of shitty for the men who fought in the war, the men and women who fought in a war, because the government didn't treat them that well in the aftermath.
Yeah.
Which, if you remember Umberto D, because, like, all the veterans, they want their military pay because the government owes them, and that's, like, that's part of the big crux of the movie, and just watching this is, like, it's never explicitly said, but I kind of assume that, like, that might be part of why he's so angry, just, like, the experience of the war, and just being stuck in this post-war Italy with, you know, like, nothing. Seemingly nothing.
Yeah, all we get to know is he's a man, and he has certain things that he wants to happen in a certain way, and if things go out of that way, he gets upset.
Yeah.
But, I can't imagine, you know, at the end of this, when it's several years later, and he finds out that Mina has died, you know, from that woman. Him being emotional about it, that's not something I could see having happened with her sister Rosa. I don't know what, you know, he didn't seem very emotional about it when he went back to the pharma or whatever it was that the lady he bought her from.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was surprised this was a road movie, because I know like basic Fellini stuff, like I mentioned some stuff I said earlier, and I knew Fellini likes circuses and clowns, and so I assumed, oh, this will be a clown drama with some comedy, and then it's like, it kind of is, but I was surprised, like, oh, it's a road movie. And, like, And like, and when they when I realized like they're not gonna stick with the circus the whole time, it's kind of like, oh, this really they're he's sticking with this road movie formula of like they're just gonna keep running into more different types of people along the way.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of unfortunate. There's not really much to say about, I feel like just like explaining the plot wouldn't be interesting because the movie isn't really about the plot. Well,
Yeah.
no, it is. It is. It's confusing to me because, like, I think this is beautifully shot and I think it's incredibly well acted. But if I had to rate it just on like a Hollywood movie scale kind of thing, I don't, I'd be like, yeah, that's like a 6 or a 7 out of 10 because it is just kind of a story told and not like the horse in the empty town or the murder of the fool, maybe the night at the nunnery, when we see how bad this guy is, I'm gonna steal silver off the wall. I feel like these are kind of us searching for more depth in a way. Like they are detailed scenes and it's cool. But I wouldn't say, yeah, it really blows me away.
Yeah, I know some. I like saw on Letterboxd, which is not necessarily the best judge, but like some people fucking love this movie, which
Sure.
I don't know. Maybe if I see more fleeting, go back to this, I'll like appreciate it more. But I remembered the other surreal scene I was thinking of. It's a it's after her first breakup with Zampano, and she walks along the road and like sits on a ditch, and then
Oh,
these
yeah.
three musicians walk by playing like circus music, and she just
Yeah.
follows them, and it like that moment is like into like when she first sees Massimo doing the tightrope thing.
Right.
And that whole and her just going to this to that new town that's following these band members, it that just feels like straight up like fairy tale out of a dream.
Yeah, it was leading her to her destiny, is what it was doing.
Oh, yeah.
This was her destiny too, That's I feel maybe this whole movie's about her destiny the whole time, and then at some point we ditch her, unfortunately. I think that ending is so sad. It kind of makes the whole movie more sad just because of how sad it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I was pretty positive that like he would drink himself to death. And it would be is gonna
He's working on it.
Yeah. Like I thought it was gonna be like he drinks himself to death and then she is stuck in it just be like she just walks along an open road to her death. And like we don't really see what happens. She just like keeps on walking. I was genuinely shocked at the oh she died a year ago or whatever. It's like oh how many years have passed? Which was just like a very quick thing of like because like time works weird in this because it's unclear how much time really goes by.
Sure, yeah. Especially at that end point, like we can see he's got like graying hair. It's pretty funny at that he gets thrown out of a bar after he finds out that she's dead because he's getting into fights. There's a guy with a haircut that is so it was so unique that I was like, okay, I can tell that obviously now this is a time paradox because that guy's hair looks exactly the same, so it can't be years later. Shut up, Joel, it's a movie. I just thought it was funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it seems to go from Yeah, whatever time he picked her up, you know, I don't know if it's summer, but they get into the winter area because it starts snowing, being cold.
Yeah, and I like you get to see the full scope of Italy because of the because I don't know for I think it starts out on the beach, and so in a warm southern part, and then it ends. Her story ends in the northern part, so she gets to see all of Italy, and it's subtle, but you get to see like the change in environment, and like they go to like from the Mediterranean part up into like the Swiss border part, which I don't think there was any German or anything, but like it's just you see the snow and like it's more mountainous, and it's like okay, they're like they like it, you, like you see a visual. Clue like visual clues of like going from the south to the north.
I mean, at the point when she gets, you know, when he decides to leave her, they're like hanging out in this like abandoned walled area. It's you know, leftovers from the war, like we would see in some of the Japanese movies we watched back in the day. It's just like these unspoken of monuments to like the destruction that had happened in the last decade or whatever.
Yeah.
And some of the, I feel like there was at least the city where she first sees the fool on the tightrope. I feel like that was a city, you know, with a capital C, you know, everything looked nice. Like it had been rebuilt and stuff like that. And there, obviously crowds big enough for the entertainment that was going on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If
you, and wherever the circus goes, which, you know, could be anywhere.
Yeah, but it feels mythical because you have like the trickster spirit, like in Mosmo, you have like the I don't know enough about mythology, but all the characters just feel like stock characters that you'd see in like in a folk tale or like in a myth. Cause like it's I have nothing more to add to that. Just it feels like in the structure feels like almost like fairy tale ish, like mythical in certain ways.
It's a tragic tale.
Yeah.
It tells you, what's the lesson from this movie? Don't murder a man on accident. No. Don't let your mama sell you for 10,000 lira or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't seem like that much.
Get
the roof fixed and feed those kids.
Yeah.
By the way, she had some young ass kids for such an old woman. Like, how long ago did her husband leave her?
That leads to the question of how old is Mina supposed to be?
Yeah.
Which the first shot of her on the beach gathering stuff, I thought she was a child, and then you see her and it's like, oh, that's a grown woman. But she's also
I think she's supposed to be young, but not like a child young.
Yeah, but like she's tiny, which I think, or she looks tiny compared to like all the men in the movie.
Yep. She is an adorable clown, and you need to appreciate what she's doing. Yeah. Somebody just be nice to her, you know? Make her a sandwich.
Hmm. Yeah.
I'm kind of out of things to say about, because I don't feel, I'm not necessarily sure that the movie requires me to say something. Like, if we had a Fellini scholar, I'd be like, hell yeah, tell me more. But I feel like we watched a solid movie. Kind of like a, you know, one of the really good Clint Eastwood, like Unforgiven or something like that. It's like, yes, that was solid and very good filmmaking and some standout performances. Yeah. But I feel like I'm doing it a disservice because it is a movie that people are like, La Strada.
Yeah. Where is it? Okay. Do you... I'm not sure if you watch the bonus stuff on Criterion Channel, but there's an interview with Scorsese.
Yep.
That... you did watch it?
I did watch it, yeah.
Oh. But it is pretty cool to see that this... That Johnny Boy came from, I think, with Massimo a little bit. He said, like, and means,
yeah, he tries to put the full character in all those movies. Yeah,
yeah, and Zampano is clearly, you know, Raging Bull, Travis Bickle. Which, mm-hmm. watching it, I think about it after watching, it's like, oh, yeah, I see that. Because I knew, because let's watch this movie, as like, I assumed Scorsese loved it, and then hear him talking about it, I was like, okay, yeah, that confirms everything. Like, my assumption there. Okay, you said you liked it. Outside of the Scorsese stuff, do you see any direct influence of this movie in things you can think, in things that are came after it?
I feel like there have been other, like, American indie movies that had this kind of structure, and like not aping the story, not even aping the performances or anything like that, but just kind of taking the bones from the way this is shot, like a road movie, and the way the story is not a happy story and not even necessarily sometimes an interesting story, but like you somehow are still sticking with it the whole time because you become invested in the characters. I feel like the bones of this movie have been, I'd see them in, you know, indie films from the 90s, but I can't say what, you know. So I guess I need to go to film jail.
I don't know. But, any particular shots or moments or whatever that stick with you?
I really like the first time that we see her as the clown, interacting with Zampano after he does his performance. You know, they do that little pretending to be hunting thing, which I'm sure was hilarious back then. You know, they rhymed some words, he misspoke some other words.
Yeah.
But it is fun to see them doing that for the first time. Hmm. Like, having some sort of rhythm and like chemistry outside of him just barking orders at her.
Yeah. Oh, I know one person that's probably influenced, Russ Meyer, because Russ Meyer loves Fellini.
Oh, yeah, and this movie has a huge pair of boobs in it.
Well, the
can we stop talking about boobs? What's wrong with you?
The curvy woman he picks up is like, fits like the Russ Meyer type.
You mean red?
Yeah, red. Like she but like, and I'm not sure if you ever watch any Russ Meyer trailers, but he wrote and narrates his own trailers, because almost all his movies were independent, because he only did like a couple studio pictures, but in multiple he calls himself the Rural Fellini, which isn't just like a random joke. Like, he genuinely did love Fellini, which watching this is like, and just thinking of Russ is like, I can kind of see like him watching this and be like, oh, I want to make movies. This is like being a start. No,
he probably watched one of the other ones.
Well, he didn't start. Well, he just started doing Nudie Cuties in the late 50s. But I just wanted to bring up like the Rural Fellini thing with Russ Meyer, which is a hilarious joke.
Yeah. He saw Lestrade and he was like, you know what? This movie would be better if it had tits in it. Say. And that started his whole oeuvre.
Then he saw other flea movies with big tits. And he was like, oh, this is the guy for me. Though he was a legit good director and cinematographer. Regardless of what you think of his movies. Because he's a photographer. He was a photographer before he was a filmmaker.
I see.
And he was serving World War II during on a film unit filming soldiers. So he knew his shit about when it came to that. Okay, any comparison? Well,
thank you for your service.
Yeah. any comparison to LaPointe Court?
Actually, yes. Yeah, I thought of one specifically. Now I'm trying to think of what it was. But I do think... I think that the story of Lestrade is happening simultaneously with LaPointe Court. But it has nothing to do with the two lovers part of the Point Court. It has to do more with, like, the interactions of the town thing. Like, you know, they're not going to end up in France, probably, but they have some other moving circus people. Maybe the fool had been up there at some other point before people got too irritated and kicked him out. But there was one part... Jeez, hold on a second. Let me ask Sarah, because I said it to her.
What is the sick kid part? Because both have a sick kid thing that shows up.
No, but that's a good one, too. Yeah. Seeing the child, his head was as big as a... She doesn't finish that sentence, but... Something happens... with... a man getting knocked off of a boat. No, that doesn't happen. Yeah, let me ask her real quick, Carla. Never mind. Apparently, I was talking about Cairo Station, which this was making me think of, too.
Oh, what part?
Just the way cinematography was going, and Cairo Station is different because it's got that, you know, it's got that noir feeling with a story going in the background. But that also feels like LaPointe Court. Maybe we should just talk about Cairo Station.
Yeah.
Because there's two different stories going on where one is like a bigger picture and the other is a murderer. This one is... let's see, what was it? Yeah. Hey, anyways, I do think that they are a good companion piece and like, it, you know, would make a pretty good double feature.
Oh, yeah.
Lestrade and LaPointe Court, that is.
Yeah, both. And they're both great. Debuts of like what both people are going to do down the road.
Mm-hmm.
I like LaPointe Court more. I'm not really sure why, because like they're both of them are not, in my opinion, not great but very good.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows, you know, like don't say a calling card, but like you get to see like if I saw this and I saw Lestrade in 1954, I would have been like, I want to see what this guy does next. But I would have had a bigger like an anticipation with LaPointe Court, because like that right, that's more my sensibility.
Sure, I mean, LaPointe Court feels more like a unique perspective idea for a film. You know, something that should not have worked in some cases, but ends up working as a total package. And like I said, like my general problem, if I had any, with Lestrade is that it does just feel like a movie. Like, there's depth and there's artistry and there's certainly touches that you won't find anywhere else under any other director. But it is still just a... this is the beginning of the story, this is the end of the story kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I honestly don't know. I like Lestrade, and yeah, I basically feel the same. Like, I do like, I would anticipate LaPointe Court's, you know, Agnès Varda's next movie more than I would participate or anticipate the next Fellini movie.
Yeah. But either way, both are very good. You can watch them on Cartoon Channel, Blu-ray, DVD. They're easily available.
Yeah, Lestrada's on HBO Max. I don't know if LaPointe Court is.
Could be. Who knows? But, I looked up, Fellini's wife. I forgot what her name was. It's something Italian that I feel like I need to hear said first before I say it.
Giulietta Masini.
Her. She's only 5'2", and Anthony Quinn was almost a full foot taller than her. So, it also was just, like, the visual of him being, like, so much bigger than she is.
Right, and they did everything that they could do to make him the imposing man. Which is, there are a lot of shots of him where he doesn't look like this, you know, when he's wearing his coat when he first goes to pick her up and things like that. There's sometimes where he looks kind of like just your average Joe kind of person. But then once he's actually set up with Mina there, so many shots of it just being like him pushing her around or occasionally even doing terrible things, being violent with her, just make him a grown, gross-looking gorilla man instead.
Yeah. Well, even like when they're not trying to make him look imposing, compared to her, like he's still like almost a foot taller than her. So like, there's only so much you can do. Like it's still like this it's still like is noticeable of like, you know, he's the one in control.
Hmm. Here's a quick question before we move on. How did you feel at the end when he was crying? Did you feel sorry for him?
I felt sorry for him, but also I felt like, well, you pushed her away and are kind of it's kind of your fault for this a bit too.
Right. Yeah.
So
that's exactly how I felt too. Yeah.
Yeah, it's complex, but like at the same time, it's like it's post-war Italy. It sucks. The economic miracle hasn't happened yet. Just gotta wait a couple more years for it to happen, and then maybe life would be better. But 1954. Other stuff came out that year. It's a pretty big year. Oh, do you know? Can you remember the other Anthony Quinn movie we talked about last season? Do you remember?
Last season.
Yeah, he's in a Spike Lee movie.
Oh, is it? She Hate Me.
He might have been dead by then.
Okay. Oh wait, yeah, he's in Jungle Fever, right?
Yeah, he's the dad of Barton Fink's dad.
Right. Wait, is he?
Oh wait, is he that dad, or is he the dad of?
I thought he was Goodfellas' mom. Dad.
Goodfellas. He's someone. He's one of the dads. One of the two dads in that movie.
Either way, he's in the movie.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to talk about Ghost Can't Do It.
No.
Because I believe he plays the titular ghost in that movie.
No. Did he end up like Jack Palance and doing like B and C movie schlock by the end of his career too?
Probably. I mean, if you're in Ghost Can't Do It, you've got to be an asshole.
Yeah. Okay, so 1954, big year. Are you going to recommend our first two episodes we ever did?
I mean, what else can I do? So, yeah, watch Seven Samurai if you haven't seen that. That's a beyond excellent 3.5 hours. Like, you look at that time, you might get intimidated, but just sit down and watch it, for God's sake. Just stop putting it off. Okay, it's from top to bottom, it is so entrancing, and amazing performances of so many of these Japanese actors that, like, we had the pleasure of looking into more of their career, you know, just because we were talking about the Japanese movies from that era. But I get the warm tingles just thinking about how good Seven Samurai is.
Yeah,
in the pantheon of films,
it's not like it's one of the classic movies that when you hear it's like, you know, it's almost perfect. It's like when I first heard of like, okay, sure, whatever. Then I watched it like, oh no, this is not overpriced. It really is like one of the greatest action movies. Like it might be the greatest action movie ever made. Like I'd put money on that.
Yeah.
And that's one of the greatest movies ever made, but like it like every like team up movie or like down to like the, you know, the Marvel Avengers movies, like they all owe it to like Seven Samurai.
Yeah. And there's a reason why it inspired, you know, so many things, because it is so good and so. Yeah, I don't even know. Like, even last season of The Mandalorian had a Seven Samurai episode, basically.
Hmm.
And you know, Lucas, he loved some of that Kurosawa stuff.
They were friends, and I wonder how Kurosawa felt about that. I imagine he probably liked it.
Yeah.
He must have, because they...
I mean, what's the other movie? Godzilla, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, Gojira.
That's a movie that Kurosawa wanted to direct, but they didn't let him.
But his best buddy directed it instead.
No fair.
Yeah.
Ishiro Hondo, is that right?
Yeah. They were like best friends.
I remember some stuff.
Yeah.
Nice.
They were supposed to start directing at the same time, but Hondo? I can't remember which one. What it is, but he was drafted and Kurosawa was not drafted.
I see. Because he's the son of a millionaire. No, I don't know.
He wasn't son of a millionaire.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the problem with 1954. I have seen some other stuff, like Human Desire, which is a Glenn Ford movie. I can't remember anything about it. Directed by Fritz Lang, too. You think I would, but
huh.
I only gave it, you know, 3 out of 5 stars.
Hmm.
Which means that it was good and somebody wanted to watch it, I wouldn't tell them not to. But yeah.
Oh.
The first samurai movie, not samurai, it's part of a samurai series, but Musashi Miyamoto.
Yeah, the Itagaki films.
Hmm.
Which Kurosawa hated those movies.
Yeah, they're okay. That's the thing. Like, I do think it's entertaining to see Toshiro Mifune in anything, but
yeah,
they're not.
They're not great.
Even the battles aren't crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, like the first. I've seen the first one. It's good. I won't say don't watch it, but you know, it's if you want more Toshiro in your life, check it out. But it's not really essential.
Anyways, that's basically all I had. Just a bunch of Japanese stuff and
Rear Window, but you know, it's everyone knows that movie,
right? Rear Window, On the Waterfront, A Dial M for Murder also came out this year.
Yeah. Okay, for me, it's I haven't talked about this in a while on the show actually, but I love Audrey Hepburn. She is my favorite actresses. Not my... maybe my favorite actress? One of them. Satsuko Hara is way up there, too. I'm not... they got a battle out. I'm not sure which is... who I'd put number one. But, Sabrina was a movie that made me... made me fall in love with Hepburn and just made me want to watch all her movies. Which I quickly learned, like, oh, she's always the best part of her movies, and her movies are rarely great. Only she's consistently great, but the movies themselves are not always great, which was kind of like the problem with going through her movies. But Sabrina, Yeah, it was if you haven't seen it in a while, you know, it's not her best by any stretch, but you know, she's a you watch it and you're like, oh yeah, she's a movie star for a reason. Like, you remember why she's an icon when you watch, like, when you watch Sabrina or Breakfast at Tiffany's, which is garbage, but
Yep.
her scenes.
Thank you. I was gonna say I'd rather watch Sabrina than Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah, George Rappard sucks. Like, all when he's on screen, it's like, oh God, can he go away? But whatever, that's my opinion of him in that movie. But my other movie is Johnny Guitar, the kind of lesbian Western with Joan Crawford and that's what not Joan Blondell, Mercedes McCambridge, and it's just a great Western. It's Nicholas Ray. There's some real like sexual tension between Joan Crawford and Mercedes McCambridge in the movie that is kind of wild that like that censors didn't pick up on just like how like coded gay this movie is. But besides that, it's just a super great Western. There's a reason it's considered like one of the great Westerns of its era, and if you haven't seen it, by all means, watch it. Like, it's one of the Westerns that got me, like, into liking Westerns. So, like, if you're kind of iffy on it, on Westerns in general, like, check this out. Like, it shows a different side of the genre.
All right, I put it on my watch list.
Yeah.
Oh, it says it's on Hulu Plus right now.
Yeah, okay. And my last is a book, People of the City by Cyprian Akwunse.
What? A book?
Yes. This was
You didn't tell me about no
the
books.
second Nigerian novel that was internationally published. I think there's the yet yeah, it was a second. And it's just about life in colonial I think it's Lagos where it's set. It's or Yeah, it's definitely Lagos where it's set. And it's just about this jazz musician and his life dealing with like dealing with like what's like to live in Lagos in 1950s when the British are kind of leaving Nigeria and there's like a push for independence, but that's all background. And he's kind of this layabout shitty guy in some ways who like has a bunch of women and stuff. And Quincy is a great writer, but he's bad with female characters, for the most part. So just remember, like, it's a book from like it's a male book from male perspective with like a guy who's kind of shitty at writing women. So I've seen some people kind of shit on Quincy now for that, but it's like you can't really blame him. It's like appreciate the art for what's actually there. And don't like don't hate it just because like he wasn't like a you know quote unquote a woke like modern thinker. Like he's you know he has flaws but like he was like there's a reason he's so such a big literary figure for like African literature.
So you're saying you kind of like this person?
Yeah, it's just I've seen some people kind of say like it's problematic because it's old. It's like, well, you have to look past that. Like, it's not whatever. It's an old question of like old art. Should you still like watch it or whatever? Like, yeah, there's still a lot of value to people of the city. It's kind of hugely important of like. What was going on in Africa at the time because no one was independent yet.
You can still, take in art from people that you might disagree with. It's not going to change your mind
Yeah.
unless you have a problem with
Yeah.
that.
Yeah. And anyway, the next pairing is oh, it's a real doozy because it's two movies I kind of don't care that much about. It's La Ventura, which is fine. based off my memory of it, and Breathless, which is fine. So hopefully I'll have more to say about it, but I really don't know how those are going to turn out. All right, and I don't know, by this point I'll have some stuff on the African History blog and the Japanese movie blog, maybe? I don't know. You got nothing?
No, I got nothing. I'm not going to announce anything or pretend I know anything, because every time I announce something, then I end up not doing it.
All right. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff. And, our special episode might be Celine Julie Go Boating, or it might be Jacques Tati. Depends on recording-wise. But, either way, it'll be something French. And, So, that's it. Watch French movies, I guess. I don't know. Be safe. Don't do stupid shit.
I thought you were gonna say don't do drugs. I don't agree with
that. Do drugs if you feel like it. Just, don't hurt anyone.
Yes. Definitely don't hurt anyone.
The show can be found on Twitter at PianoPlayerPod. Our email is still highandlowpod@gmail.com. You can find a show on Spotify, Podbean, and various other places where you can find podcasts. Our intro music is by Vivian Fopp, and our cover art is by Sarah Roberts. You can find her art, sarahkathleenroberts.com. And thank you for listening.